Hello, everybody. Welcome to WIC Live. I am Dan Selke, the editor at WinnersComing.net. I am here with Cheryl Wassenaar, an editor at Culturist.com.
Hey, Dan.
And as we do every week, we are here to talk about all things Game of Thrones and A Song of Ice and Fire. Hey to everybody who's watching. Hey, Corey Thone. Hey, Helen. Jack, Marsha, Diane. Everybody, thanks for coming here. And today we are fortunate because we had something happen that very rarely happens these days, Cheryl.
Do tell, Dan.
George R. R. Martin, author of A Song of Ice and Fire, he's not a J.D. Salinger-level recluse or anything, but he does not give a lot of public appearances anymore because he's, you know, busy working on The Winds of Winter, we assume. But WorldCon is coming up, the World Science Fiction Convention. He has an old place in his heart. He always goes to it. He always attends. And yesterday, he gave an onstage interview to a man whose name we'll mispronounce, an artist, just say that. I don't say his name because I don't remember what it was. And he had to do a question and answer session with the audience. And he talked at some length about A Song of Ice and Fire, about Game of Thrones, about just where it fits in the greater fantasy canon, about being a writer. It's rare to get this much from Mr. Martin. Some of his comments about HBO's Game of Thrones, about his own work, were pretty interesting, I think, worth discussing. Did you see any of it happen?
I did not see any of it happen. I'm glad I'm sitting down for this. You gave me all this news in one kind of shot here, and I'm very glad that I've got the arms to clutch to, because George R. R. Martin said things in public. What?
And if you stood, you would knock over the microphone.
Well, yeah, that too. We don't have the equipment for me to do standing sessions. But
we'll get there.
But we'll get there eventually. I did look over some of the comments, and I am intrigued by the things he said, because he has always been a writer that has opinions, and so it doesn't shock me that he still has opinions.
I don't know.
It's just fascinating to see what his opinions are. I know you've got the highlights, Dan.
It's also cool because he's a writer who has always had opinions, but he's you know, not that long ago in the span of his life, he wasn't that famous. So he could, like, say whatever he wants, and it's not going to cause too much ruffles. But now, I think part of the reason he doesn't talk much anymore is because he knows if he says something now, then places like WIC are going to pick it up and talk about it, and he's going to get a lot of either, like, reaction, either pushback or praise or whatever. So it's...
Yeah.
I don't say that up front. I don't want to criticize George R. R. Martin. He's in a position... Anyway, some stuff he said talked about Song of Ice and Fire. He said some very interesting things. For example, I think this probably is the first time he was asked straight up, like, are the remaining books in your series, The Winds of Winter and A Dream of Spring, going to be like what we've seen on Game of Thrones, the show, recently? Like, are they going to be a draft for what you're doing? And he basically said, no. Like, my books are not going to be the same, which we've always kind of known, but it's good to have just, like, that specificity. Mm. He even said that characters who have died on the show are going to never die in the books. Not just survive past that. They will never die. He said that the show has been a lot more bloodthirsty than he has, which is interesting. But why? Why do you laugh?
Seems like kind of a lie. Like, the show... learned its bloodthirstiness from the source material.
It did, it has ticked it up.
Yes.
Like, it already has killed folk that haven't died in the page yet. Like, Barristan Selmy is a famous one.
Right.
He's still alive, and it's about the same point. He died even earlier than he does in the books.
Mm-hmm.
Pip and Gren, Jon Snow's little bosom buddies at the Wall, they both died in the show. They're alive in the books. Who do you think has died in the show that might end up living through the whole shebang?
I'm gonna gamble and say the Sand Snakes.
Really?
Yeah. And
no, any particular reason? Say anything one.
Because I want them to live, because they need justice for what happened to them in the show.
I love that one, okay.
But beyond that, Dorne has been a lot more important in the books than it is in the show. Like, the Dornish subplots in the show have been kind of mishandled, I think would be a nice word for it.
I think that's pretty well accepted.
Yeah.
It's kind of controversial to say.
Yeah, it's not a hot take to say that they've been mishandled. Yeah. The hot take is the Sand Snakes living.
That is a hot take.
I think that the women of Dorne are going to have a better... they're going to fare better in the books than they have in the show. I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. but it's a thing nevertheless. Like, that is my kind of gut check.
Sure.
I think these characters will be treated differently. What about you, Dan? Who do you have money on to
first,
live?
That's interesting that you would say that. I mean, this is a bit of a hot take, too, kind of different discussion, but I have the opinion that the Dornish characters are almost as dumb and useless on the books as they are on the show. I'm not a big fan of them in the books, either. But they're bad in different ways. But it's a different sort of discussion. It'd be interesting, though. I mean, if he can turn them into great characters in The Winds of Winter, more power to you. Bring on interesting sand snakes. What we got so far, though, frankly, I thought they were pretty bland.
Yeah, I mean, they're not great in the books. And I agree that the characters in Dorne are not smart in the books, either.
It's just kind of a diversion. Let's not talk about that right now.
Okay, that's for another show.
It's a whole can of snakes and worms.
Too many slithery things.
When I first heard that, when he said that some characters who died in the books will never die, who have died in the show will never die in the books, my first thought went to the Tyrells, like Margaery and Loras, and that whole family. I'm not convinced we'll get the sept explosion in the books. I think that might be an invention for the show.
I could see that. I mean, I think that it's not impossible that Cersei will find a way to kind of murder the Tyrells. But yeah, I don't know if it's going to be quite as cinematic in the books. I think that might be something that... I don't want to say it was an invention for the show, but I think it was kind of dulled. It could have been dulled up for the show, if you will.
The reason I say is because just based on the way the creators talk about it, like when they talk about things like Shireen dying, getting burned at the stake, they say straight up, like, when George R. R. Martin told us about this, we were like, what? Or like Hodor's death. When they're like, when George R. R. Martin told us about this, we were like, oh my God, that's intense. When they talk about the sept explosion, they were like, we wanted to do something that we kind of had the pieces for and we needed a big finish. It makes me think maybe that is a show invention, and a great show invention, by the way, if that is the case. And I always did love the Tyrells, so if they could manage, especially Margaery, so if they managed to stick it out and survive the whole book series, I'd be pretty pleased.
I just want Olenna to get her Tell Cersei I Know It Was Me
another great bit,
on the page as well. So I think it's possible that the Tyrells kind of have the same fates, but not exactly the same. If you will.
Oh, no.
Maybe they can just capture Olenna or something.
At the end of the day, it's very hard to know how much the books will actually mirror the show. And we'll only know when and if The Winds of Winter ever comes out. We have some comments here, people saying...
All right, what are they saying?
Some pessimism from at least one person. Laura, you won't ever get the books, so what else do we have? It's possible. I think we'll get the next book. I'm not 100% convinced in the last one. Oh, Lisa asks, is reading the books confusing after watching the TV show? Which is a good question.
A little bit.
Did you watch the show first or go to the books first?
No, I read the books first.
Okay.
At least the first couple books first.
I gotcha. Well, Lisa, I did watch the show and then I read the books and I didn't have any problem with it at all.
No.
I think it's confusing.
I definitely read the tie-in, like the show tie-in version of Game of Thrones first, but I read at least the first couple books before I saw the show. So, no, it's not really confusing.
It's not confusing, Lisa.
No, not really confusing.
Things in your head.
You can do it. We believe in you.
And Ephraim asks, is there a way you could see the interview with J.R.R. Man you guys were talking about? I recommend going to winterscoming.net. We have written it up. It was on a stage. It wasn't a written interview. It was something he, talked on a stage. Mm-hmm. So there's some video of it, but mostly it's just through eyewitness accounts that we've collected. All right. Let's move on to, speaking of The Winds of Winter, of course he addressed it a bit. He had to. If you're talking to George R. R. Martin and he's giving you carte blanche to ask him about A Song of Ice and Fire, you're going to ask, how's The Winds of Winter coming, George? And I mean, nothing new. He just said, I'm working on it. Let's see. Working on it. Believe me, you'll know when it's done. It will be the shot that's heard around the world. So, okay, keep working on it. End of story.
Yeah.
Something else interesting he said was that he figured that he was going to have more time to finish Winds of Winter. He thought he would have like 2 more years before the show caught up to him, which I think he's implying that he figured that HBO would take longer to adapt A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons books. They kind of collapsed into season five, little scatterings elsewhere. Let me ask you a question for this. It's a two-parter.
Oh, boy.
They're related.
Okay, that helps.
Was George R.R. Martin fooling himself when he assumed that HBO would take two or even more seasons to adapt those two books? And did HBO make the right call in culling a lot of that material? Because as we know, I mean, the show adapted the books reasonably faithfully for the first four or so seasons, and then a lot started to get cut. And it was right around when they got to Feast for Crows, Dance with Dragons.
I'm going to go with a double hot take here. Well, okay. Take hot take and a half, I think. Yes, he was fooling himself. Mm-hmm. B, yes, HBO made the right call. And I will expand further on both of these points.
I agree with you on both points.
Oh, okay, good. Maybe not quite as hot of a take as I thought.
But do you, dear viewers?
Yes, do tell us. So yes, Martin was fooling himself. Feast for Crows and Dance with Dragons take place at the same, effectively at the same time.
Right.
And if you read the books, a lot of them, they're a little fillery. Fillery.
It's rough to say, but yeah. I totally see where you're coming from.
They're a little fillery. And so it does make sense that HBO would kind of look at these two books that take place at the same, roughly in the same timeline, mm-hmm. and say, we can condense this into one season because, you know, a little bit of filler. And honestly, not interesting filler. For those of you who are starting to read the books, like, the first three are great, and then Feast for Crows and Dance with Dragons can be a little disappointing.
I think a distinction I'll make is that I don't think George R.R. Martin would see any of it as filler. And I think there's a good argument that it's you could look at it as just intense world building and deep dive character building. And I think it is. It's just maybe a little injudicious in the way it's structured and streamlined, or the way that it's not streamlined or structured.
Yes, I think that's fair to say. And when I say filler, I don't mean that it's not interesting reading, mm-hmm. or anything like that. It's just...
It is well written. It is interesting reading.
It's just very kind of different, like even tonally and, as you said, structurally, from the first three books. So it's a little hard to kind of find that interesting. And in the same sense, like intense world building and intense character building doesn't make good TV.
Yes, exactly.
Not in the same way.
Yes, you can have it.
Right.
But, you know, TV is a bit of a more propulsive medium. And you want a plot that moves. And again, I've often said this. It's kind of too bad that we don't have a big book defender on the show. I will try to get one. If anyone wants to come on the show and talk about the books and defend them to the hilt, feel free. I've always said that the first three books, you know, they have world building, character building, and plot momentum. And then the last two kind of, they have the first two things that kind of drop the plot momentum.
Yeah. I think Martin has kind of talked before about how he was writing what was Feast at the time and then said, this is getting too big. I need to make it another, split it.
Right.
And I mean, on some level, splitting it was the right decision because otherwise we would have had like a 1600 page tome or something like that. But the other right decision would have been,
let's chop out some stuff I don't need.
Editing would be so great. Yeah.
So I agree with you that HBO made the right call in cutting it down. Mm-hmm. Now, I can and do quibble with what they chose to cut and how they chose to cut it. I think they could have made some more intelligent cuts.
Yes.
But cutting it down, it was always going to get cut down. One way or another, it's just a matter of how you do the cuts, mm-hmm. correctly. It is a little sad. Do you think that at the end of the day, we're not really going to have a perfect version either way, either the books or the show? As much as I love them both, and I do, we're here, you know.
We are on this show.
The one's going to be a little too long-winded and the one's other's going to be a little too curtailed.
I mean, I don't think there's ever really a perfect story
That's true.
So I just don't get my hopes up with anything anymore. That way I'm less disappointed when things don't turn out as well.
All right, that's Cheryl Wassenaar's way of doing this. Just lower your expectations and everything will be pretty good.
Pessimism. It's great. It serves me well.
Any other thoughts, Cheryl, you have before we bring on Josh Hill to talk about A Song of Ice and Fire in detail?
Yeah, he gets to talk about it in detail. No, I mean, are there any interesting comments that we need to
discuss? Here we go. How about this? Dan Turton has a pretty long comment. If you read A Feast for Crows, Dance with Dragons in chronological order, preferably on a Kindle, they are great. I found a list on Reddit for what order to read them in. It's very, very good, which is true. When I read through them last, I read through, I think it was called A Feast with Dragons, something like that, or Dance with Crows. I honestly forget. But yeah, it is a different experience. I think we'll do that when we get to that in A Song of Dan and Josh. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there are ways around it. It's just so unusual. I mean, to split a book into two parallel times, different location story. I can't think of any other example of that happening.
Yeah, I can't really. I mean, there are stories that will do multiple timelines, but not quite in the same kind of contemporaneous way.
Here's the fourth and fifth volumes of a five-volume series, and now we're going to start splitting it up.
Right. It's a little weird in when the split happens and how the split is handled.
And I want to qualify. I did read them, you know, back and forth, but it's still slow going. Like, it's still very built up. But you know what? Let's talk about it in a little more detail on a segment of the show we like to call A Song of Dan and Josh. Each week, thank you, Cheryl. You're wonderful. You're beautiful.
Goodbye.
Where each week, Josh Hill and I, fans and editor Josh Hill, go over a chapter or two from A Song of Ice and Fire. I've read the books multiple times. Josh has never read the books. We're going through it bit by bit, breaking it down, see what makes it work, makes it doesn't work. We're still on A Game of Thrones, the first book in the series. Getting toward the end, though.
Yeah.
And today we read Tyrion 8, yes. A pretty crucial chapter, because there is fight, fight, fight.
There is. Basically, the chapter boils down to Tyrion goes into battle. Mm-hmm. Tywin pretty much expects him to die. He doesn't die. And that's not surprising to me because... Tyrion's entire he's around, but also because Tyrion's entire character seems to be Tywin wishes he was dead, and here Tyrion is. So this whole scenario of Tywin not really concocting the battle, because the battle is needed because Tywin wants to, he's got his thing with the Starks, but within this he's kind of like, ooh, I can kill two birds with one stone, I can win this battle and also get rid of my imp son. So didn't happen.
But. Can you imagine? Like, it's that part at the toward the end of the chapter when the battle's been won, the Lannisters win, Tyrion impales a horse with a giant spike on his helmet, and he talks to his father, and his Tywin's basically like, yeah, I thought you'd die, but, you know, we didn't, we won. Like, just the shamelessness and just the openness of it. Like, your father is admitting he thought you'd probably die, and he would have been okay with that. Like, I'm not sure we can underline thoroughly enough how deep Tyrion's daddy issues go when you have a father like that who is openly contemptuous of you being alive.
Yeah, right.
And might even plan for your death. And then you have to, like, go after up to him after the battle and say, we won. Orders, please, father. Mm-hmm. Like, it's got to be hard on Tyrion.
It does. Speaking of hard, I forgot to say hi to everybody. Hello,
yes,
everybody.
You better say hi.
Julie and Julie.
Renee
right?
says hi. Julie Renee. Says hi. Yes.
Who else we... Michael Douglas here?
I don't think Douglas, your favorite Michael Douglas.
It was just weird, but also fitting because Tywin's a bastard. Like, he is just a cold man. And it doesn't surprise me that he would basically have to deal with this scenario with Tyrion afterwards and just be like, I thought you were going to die. But
let's move on.
Yeah.
This is usual. And Tyrion has to swallow that. Mm-hmm. Let's go back a little further. So this chapter, it's the first battle scene of the series. It also introduces us to some new characters. Mm-hmm. So the first part is Tyrion is talking at the end of the grand table with his father and his father's retainers and advisors and everything. They're planning for the battle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, true to Tyrion, Tywin's like, we're going to put you in the vanguard, which is the first wave of combatant soldiers, medieval terminology.
Yeah.
And he's like, what? I'm going to die. And he's like, fine, you'd rather be in back? Like, no, I'll be in the vanguard. I'll do it. which is another little quirk of his daddy issues.
Yep.
Like, he could have gotten out of it.
He wants to prove himself.
He does. Like, yeah. He hates his father, but he wants to prove himself anyway. Mm-hmm. It's bad. It's classic. Really bad.
That's classic daddy issues.
I guess it is.
With all these characters that we've seen have to deal with it over the years in movies and TV and books. It's like, I hate my dad, but I want his, all I want him to do is hug me and tell me that he loves me one time. And this is textbook that. Like,
it really
is. He's like, I'm not going to go into the back because I'm going to be up front. And if I die, then I'm going to be dying trying to honor my father who wishes I was never born.
It took a word from Tywin to get him to say that. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just, like, Tyrion's supposed to be a really intelligent character, but his father can, like, just pull a tiny string and he jumps.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost sad. Anyway, he goes back to his tent, and we meet two characters that we know very well. We'll see for a while. We got Podrick Payne,
yep,
who is Tyrion's new squire. He just gets a single line here, but it's a pretty good line. Tyrion was like the lad with a distant relation to Sir Ilyn Payne, mm-hmm, who you might remember had his tongue cut out by the Mad King, and almost as quiet.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just kind of a shy, reclusive guy. But, you know, we know he'll grow into something else. And more importantly, or at least more prominently, he meets Shay,
mm-hmm,
the mysterious prostitute from parts unknown.
Yes.
What was your impression of Shay first time?
Well, I remember her from the show.
Sure.
So I recalled the character. I was like, ooh, this is important. Let's put this in the back of my mind.
Yeah, she'll play a pretty big role.
Yeah. And so my impression, I didn't really have a fresh impression because the impression was, oh, I remember this from the show. This is going to be,
right,
I'm going to have to stow this away. This is going to be important. But I was interested because I'd forgotten about her. And then here was her introduction. I was like, oh, that's right. Because at this point in the book, we've met so many characters. And as much as a reference to the TV show as being like, oh, I remember it from this, this was a thing where I had forgotten about this character up until now. So it was kind of like an aha moment. Where
I guess it's a good point. I mean, because she hasn't come off as someone who's going to be important, mm-hmm, and there's no reason to think she will be. I guess I'm looking at this from like a retrospective perspective, where I'm like, I'm looking at what she does because I know she's going to be important. I liked her though. Like, they gave her funny lines, like that. Hearing just that thing where like, I'm Tyrion Lannister. Men call me the Imp, and mm-hmm, she's like, I am Shay. Men call me often. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, she's funny.
Yeah,
she's
well, clever. That's the point too, because Tyrion's supposed to be falling in love with her. Like, Tyrion's supposed to be having like a connection.
Right.
So I did
and
like
they're
that.
Both wits.
Yeah,
which makes sense.
And I appreciated that the way that it was written by Martin, mm-hmm, where it's, if I wouldn't have been reading this knowing that she was going to become an important character, I would have still picked up on, oh, there's something here. There's clearly,
but there's an actual spark.
Yeah, there's supposed to be chemistry. I'm supposed to be understanding the chemistry here. So that to me, it was, I picked up on that regardless of knowing about the show.
Cool. But the other part of the relationship is, okay, so there's chemistry. There's a spark. She is a prostitute. Yeah. He is buying her.
Yep.
Bronn literally stole her from some other dude and is like, here.
Yep.
And they have this, Tyrion has this talk to her where he's like, okay, here's how it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want you to see anybody else. I want you to massage me, talk to me, have sex with me.
Mm-hmm.
He's buying a friend and he's buying a lover. And mm-hmm, Shay's like, okay, cool. Let's do it now.
Yeah.
It's, again, it's kind of like Tywin, like the honesty of how transactional this is.
Yeah.
Was it surprising at all?
A little bit. But Tyrion is written differently in the book than he was on the show. So it didn't surprise me because we've seen kind of, or read, Tyrion being a little colder than you remember
colder,
him on the show. So there is more, there's more to that I read in the book than the kind of wittiness and the more likable character that Peter Dinklage is on the show.
One-liner, tart tongue. He has all that.
Yeah,
but
so, and then it also reiterates to me the dynamic, like you mentioned with Tywin, like, mm-hmm, there is that daddy issue thing. There is the, I want to be like my father, even though I don't want to be like my father. It's just the natural, that's my heritage. So that to me came off well as far as him talking to her so transactionally. But
for sure. And there's also the aspect, I mean, the big point to me was toward the end of their talk.
Yeah.
When he gets up, the horses are coming, the enemy's upon them. And he turns to her and says, if I die, weep for me,
mm-hmm,
which is ridiculous in a way because they met last night and he bought her. I mean, this isn't, they don't have a connection.
No.
But
he wants to be loved, though. That's the thing. That's his story.
He's so needy.
Yeah, he just needs to be loved. He can just buy it and be like, yes, this will be my legacy. There will be somebody crying for me if I fall in battle gallantly. It's like, no, not really.
I'm not sure that we think of Tyrion as a needy character, but he really is.
Yeah.
And we get a great glimpse of it here because we got, I think it goes back to the father stuff. Like, mm-hmm. he's needy because his daddy won't love him, which you say is the oldest story in the book. Mm-hmm. And we got it here.
Yep.
All right, before we go, we got to hit the battle itself.
The battle.
So this is the first large-scale battle scene mm-hmm. in the book series. Do you remember how they adapted this on the show?
I don't know.
Okay, it's a funny bit. So it's season one. Uh-huh. They have, like, $11. The way they happen on the show is Tyrion goes out, gets in the battle, knocked on the head, knocked out, and then they fade out, fade back in after it's over.
Oh, clever.
They do the classic, we're just going to shoot this battle by not shooting at all, because we do not have the money.
That actually reminds me, in Batman and Robin, they do the same thing. So Batman is chasing Mr. Freeze, and they're like jumps across a building. It looks like it's going to be this huge thing. And Mr. Freeze and Arnold Schwarzenegger is like, oh, I got you, or whatever. And then Batman just comes across in the Batmobile and drops his cape over the windshield. And then it's a jump cut to Batman then whipping the cape away, and Mr. Freeze is on the ground arrested. And I was like, what the hell? Like, come on, you just totally cut. Like, that's when you know that's the part of the production they ran out of money.
Sure.
And that reminds me here, Game of Thrones. Now you've got Battle of the Bastards and, you know, the big siege at the wall.
Oh, yeah. Now money is not a problem.
Now, you can do whatever you want. Back to this, and it's like they have to do these little, like, almost shady things to mm-hmm. be like, yes, don't look at the man behind the curtain. Let's just keep moving on with the story. So,
how long have you been holding out of that Batman and Robin complaint?
It comes up a lot more than you would think it does.
It reminds me of what happens in The Hobbit, which is Bilbo, the Battle of Five Armies. He goes out. It's going to be epic. Knocked on the head with a rock, knocks out. And then in the damn movies, they make it into a full movie of a battle, which I did not like. And it happened in reverse in Game of Thrones. So what about the battle itself? How did you find the way Martin writes war?
I mean, the battle itself, it reminded me a little bit of the chapter with...
Oh, by the way, Dan Turton, terrible movie, Josh. Why remind us of this?
It is a terrible movie, and I want everybody to share in my shame of this. It's a weird rewatchable. But maybe we talk about that in another episode. But this chapter reminded me of the chapter with Jamie and Ned, and when Ned has to fight. Yeah, so okay. we've had battle-ish things before from George R. R. Martin, but the full-scale war to me, I found it really engaging. Like it's the way that he writes it. It's very engaging, and it's not. I don't know. We talk about how he can kind of describe a cape and overly describe a cape. It feels like he's very punchy and he really gets his points across when he's writing the battles, which is a point where I would think maybe he gets a little more flamboyant with it and wants to really get into the details and the swings of the swords and all these types of things.
Sure.
It's very cut and dry,
it flowed.
The way that battle is. And I feel that that's the way, well, from what I can assume. And that's what I got across.
Medieval battle.
That's what
like
I got across.
Thing we have foam swords.
Right. That's what I got across from Martin. It's very
cut and dry
because battle, there's not much more to it than fighting death, trying to survive.
I mean, as a writer, if you lingered on, like, I don't know, a sword in the middle of battle for a page, it almost would feel weird because that's not the reality of it's going to happen very, very quickly.
There's no romanticizing it.
Let me read a little bit of his battle prose. This is Tyrion going into battle after he tries to lead his clansmen into battle, and then they, like, ride ahead of him. Mm-hmm. He's very big on the chaos of it. He glimpsed Timmit, son of Timmit, vault free of as his mount died under him in full stride. Saw a moon brother impaled on a Karstark spear, watch Khan's horse shatter a man's ribs with a kick. A flight of arrows descended on them. Where they came from, he could not say, but they fell on Stark and Lannister alike, rattling off armor or finding flesh. So it's just kind of like a cacophony, a tumult. Like, there are arrows. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're hitting you or your friends. I don't know who your friends are. Mm. It's very chaotic.
It's very claustrophobic, the way it reads.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, because that gets the point across.
It does. And actually, that bit about the arrows just kind of raining on everybody, there's a direct shot like that in the Battle of the Bastards. Mm. And the creators have said that they use, like, Jon Snow, just like arrows. Just like
boom, boom, that's right.
They use this battle as inspiration for Battle of the Bastards. The Battle of the Bastards was, we have the money to do this now. We can actually do this right.
Right.
And I think they pulled that off, because that battle's pretty famous. There were some parts of the battle that I did not remember that almost seemed like goofy.
Mm-hmm.
Like the way, like excessive. Like the way Tyrion's horse bites the cheek out of the one guy
fighting.
Ugh. And then Tyrion is wearing this great helm that, like, obscures your entire face.
The helmet.
With a foot-long spike on top of it.
Yeah.
And he uses the spike to just impale a horse.
It's like the...
They do not have those on the show. They don't. We lose the Great Helms.
It's like the, you know, it's only a flesh wound guy from Monty Python.
It is.
It's exactly what it is. And I just was picturing Tyrion, like short little Tyrion, like wearing this helmet. And I was picturing it like being too big for him.
Oh, totally. It's a great
image. a very comical image that I think they probably did a good thing not including that on the show.
But I mean, to impale a horse with a spike on your head, that's a straight up Monty Python kind of. I don't know how that could possibly look cool on TV.
No, that's... It's. I think that's when Game of Thrones jumps the shark. So,
but I mean, if it happened in the books, be faithful.
There you go.
All right. Any other thoughts, Josh, on Tyrion 8, the first battle?
No, running out of real estate. So
we are, but we're going to slow down a little bit. Mm-hmm. Next week, we'll only read one other chapter. I believe it's the next Catelyn chapter, which will bring us a battle of a very different kind. And we'll see you there. I know we got through this a little quickly. We'll slow down a little bit in the future. We kind of had a go for this one. We'll see you back here next Wednesday, 4 p.m. Central Standard Time on the Winter's Coming Facebook page for more Game of Thrones news, more Song of Ice and Fire discussion, and more interaction with you beautiful people. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next week.